Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The last day that Catholic Answers Live will ever be a teenager. Tomorrow the show turns 20. We'll have a big 20th anniversary special edition. I hope you'll join us. We'll have all kinds of fascinating guests. Some of them we are keeping top secret until tomorrow. Hope you'll join us then. This hour is Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum means if you've got a question about the Catholic faith, it doesn't matter who you are or what the question is, we're going to try our best to address it. Just give us a call, 888-318-7884. We're always very grateful when non-Catholics take an interest in the Catholic faith and call to ask a question. You're very welcome. But Catholics are welcome as well, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour, as he was last hour, is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. So I have a question for you.
Yes.
During the secret part of the show everybody gets to hear.
You can't talk about the secret part of the show. Okay, I guess you can.
Just can't disclose it. But if you're watching us
I think we should say what the secret part is.
So if you're watching us on like Facebook or YouTube between the hours, we may be able to interact with you there and just have a little bit more discussion and stuff. So during that segment, you were it's like the secret chairs that we can't talk about, you know.
The secret chairs really are secret. They're here in the studio. No one ever sits in them.
We never use them. You said that you'd finally seen the new Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi.
I was in the process of asking,
what did you think when we had to come back?
And suddenly we just had to go and I never got to answer the question.
So what did you think?
I liked it. Mm-hmm. I liked it. I have to say of all the Star Wars movies, mm-hmm. my favorite is Rogue One.
Okay.
I just think it's such a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't think it was like Rogue One. It didn't displace Rogue One.
You like Hamlet, too. I'm betting of Shakespeare's plays. Everybody dies.
You're not supposed to say that. Now you're giving away secrets you shouldn't give away. Yeah. I do like that part of Hamlet where he says, "What a piece of work is man." I love mm-hmm. that little monologue there. But no, I like the comedies like Romeo and Juliet, Macbeth. Mm-hmm. I like all the, mm-hmm. the funny light ones.
You know what I liked is the reduced Shakespeare Company's production of the complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged.
Yes.
It's a lot of fun.
I have to say, I was not aware of it until you made me aware of it, and it's absolutely delightful. You should – I don't know how people can see that. Like, is it available online? Do you buy it?
I got it on Amazon Instant Video.
Yeah. If you like Shakespeare – and if you don't like Shakespeare, either way.
It's hilarious anyway.
There's two kinds of people in this world, people who like Shakespeare – and people who have never seen Shakespeare. Open forum today on what did you think of the new Star Wars movie?
I liked it too. It wasn't perfect. I had some criticisms of it. I thought the recurring leitmotif of brash male character needing to be restrained by wise female character was a little over the top. But in terms of the basic story choices they made, they did some things that you wouldn't expect in a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
And they took some risks. And I thought that was okay. They need – because if you just recycle what we've seen before, it's going to get boring real fast.
Right.
I mean if it's all just predictable, this character is going to get in a lightsaber battle and then that's going to happen. You know, it's too predictable – it's going to be boring really fast. So Disney needs to find ways to push the Star Wars envelope and make it more diverse. And Rogue One is an example of that.
Yeah.
Because Rogue One is the first tragedy. True tragedy in the Star Wars universe and on the big screen. And so I think from a storytelling perspective, from a writing perspective, which is what interests me, you do need to diversify the emotional palette of colors you get to paint with.
Yeah.
And you do need to do some surprising moves that just weren't what everyone was expecting.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And they did do that. I was realizing, however, as you were speaking, because you just what you were saying in the first movie that they – the new ones they made, The Force Awakens, mm-hmm. I loved the character of Finn, John Boyega.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't enough Finn in this movie. I love that. John Boyega is a great actor, mm-hmm. and that's a great character, mm-hmm. Finn. And so
– he was in this one a little. Maybe he'll have a stronger role in the next one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that's the junior characters are going to have to be stronger in the next movie because now all of the established characters are in a position where they're not going to be able to take lead roles.
I just hope the next movie ends with them blowing up a Death Star and then Ewoks dancing around.
I'm hoping for something a little more envelope pushing there. I wasn't wild about that the first time around.
I can sing the Ewok song. All right, back to calls.
Yub Yub or the other version?
I don't know. You're way more advanced in your knowledge than I am of all things, but certainly including Star Trek and Star Wars. 888-318-7884, our number, 888-31-TRUTH. If you have a question having to do with any religion, including that force religion. What's that? Is there a name for that religion, that force
the
religion?
The Jedi faith.
Oh, the Jedi faith. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dang it. I should have known that.
Your sad devotion to that ancient religion hasn't enabled you to divine the location of the secret rebel base.
Man. Thanks, Tarkin.
I find your lack of faith disturbing. I love that line. That's the best line.
Okay, we could just sit here for this hour and have Jimmy do Star Wars. No, we're done that. All right. Well, let's go to Lewis in Brooklyn, New York, listening on the Catholic Answers app. First, Lewis, let me say thank you for downloading the app, and then your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, thank you. So basically, my question is kind of similar to the caller before. I've been having a lot of friends and family who are becoming vegans, and mm-hmm. basically they're making the claim that animals and humans have the same value in life.
Oh.
So therefore, it's the same way it's immoral to kill a human being, it would be immoral to kill an animal for food. Okay. And there's some that don't take that strong of a position where they say, no, there are differences between animals and humans, but the difference only lies in, like, when it comes down to survival. So in the fact that we have the means and the ability and the technology to choose alternatives, then eating meat would be unnecessary. Therefore, it becomes immoral still in their mind. So I just don't know how to respond to that.
Okay. Well, let me ask a question. So what reasons do the people who – because we got two different groups here. What reasons do the people who say that that animals have the same value as humans, what reasons do they give for that? How do they defend that?
I it seems like they don't really have it solid, their real reasons. They just say the same way, like in society, we all agree that human beings should not be killed for mm-hmm. food. Then we're progressing to a time where we could say this, we could apply the same rights to animals. Like, it's not really a solid argument, and they mm-hmm. seem to contradict themselves, and they go in circles.
Okay.
But that's the best I can summarize what they're saying to me.
So they're not citing, like, religious reasons for this?
No.
Are they religious people?
One of them, but majority of them, no. No.
Okay, well.
That's why I kind of want, like, an answer, like, outside of, like, any religious argument. Yeah.
So when you encounter someone who is religious, especially if they're a Jew or a Christian, I would point out that, okay, God commanded the Hebrews to eat the Passover lamb, and Jesus ate the Passover lamb, and Jesus performed at least two great big huge hunting miracles, because both at the beginning of his ministry and at the end of his ministry, he enabled St. Peter and his companions to have two miraculously large catches of fish. Well, fishermen are fish hunters, and so Jesus didn't have a problem hunting animals. In fact, he miraculously helped it happen. So anybody who is coming from a position that would respect Jesus, especially religiously, should recognize that it's legitimate in principle to take animal life and to use animals for our benefit, including eating them. Now, in terms of people who are coming from a non-religious perspective, if they're taking this strong position that says humans and animals are of the same value, then I would want to say, okay, really? Because that's going to lead to some really really difficult situations if that's what you really believe. I mean, if an ant has the same value as a human being, that means every time you walk across a parking lot and unintentionally step on an ant, you're committing homicide or the equivalent of homicide. I mean, it may be hymenoptericide, but it's the equivalent of homicide. And so you need to take the same precautions against stepping on an ant that you would need to take against running over a person. And that's going to lead you into a situation very quickly where you're going to have to be really scrupulous and really paranoid, and I suspect you're going to find it unlivable. And that's a sign that we're just not meant to treat ants as if they're the equivalent of human beings. And ants are the least of our problems here because they're not the only animals out there in the world. There are all kinds of one-celled animals and microscopic animals, and you're breathing them in all the time, and they're going down your throat, and they're encountering your immune system, and your immune system is killing them right and left because that's, you know, its job. And so if you want to treat those microorganisms as if they're just as valuable as human beings, you're gonna need to cripple your own immune system and die. So that also would be unlivable. And so I would say that's another sign that we're just not meant to treat every life form as if it's the equivalent of a human being. So if we can agree on that principle, then we can say, okay, well, maybe we need to make some distinctions here. Maybe we don't need to treat microscopic organisms or ants the same way we need to treat, say, gorillas or chimpanzees or dolphins, animals that have more qualities that are human-like, and maybe we need to treat them a little differently. Okay, fine. We can agree on that. I don't want to carve up a gorilla and eat it the same way I'd be willing to carve up a turkey and eat it, or a fish or something like that. I'm not saying it would be wrong for me to do it. But we can acknowledge that, you know, as animals gain cognitive ability and as they gain sensitivity to things, it makes sense to respect that. And that leads to the next position, which was the one saying, okay, if we have the ability to avoid killing animals, then we should. Well, there's an element of truth there. If you don't need to take a life for some reason, then why bother taking it? Now, there's a trade-off here. I suspect that in the future, we're going to be eating lab-grown meat. That really, once they have it perfected to where lab-grown meat, I mean, they're working on it now, but I've suspected for years in the future, we're gonna be eating meat that is genuine meat. It's made out of animal cells, but it never came off an animal. It's grown in a pan and, you know, is, I don't know, electrically stimulated to give the nerve fibers the right texture or something like that. But we're going to be eating synthetic meat. And at that point, once the quality of synthetic meat comes up to the level of regular meat, and once the price comes down to the price level of regular meat, it'll make all the sense in the world to say, okay, this is just as good. It's just as cheap. This is what I'm going to eat because I don't want to have to have an animal killed. And a lot of farms that we have now will go away. The same way the horse population is not as great as it used to be before the invention of the automobile. And I suspect the same exact thing is going to happen to the animal husbandry industry. Yeah. It's largely going to vanish. But until that happens, until the quality of artificial meats and the expense of obtaining them is comparable to real meat, there's nothing wrong with eating real meat. And that's true for a lot of people in our society because these alternatives either aren't as good or they don't have the same ratios of nutrients and stuff. Or they don't taste as good, if you've ever tried some of them, as I have, or they're more expensive. And if that's true, even here in America, it's even more true in other parts of the world. It's just not the case yet that substitute meats are on the same playing field as real meat. And so even though in the future we can agree, sure, this is likely going to happen and it will be a compassionate solution in the future, we're just not there yet. So that's how I'd approach it.
Lewis, thanks very much for the call. We have to go to a break. I do remember, Jimmy, one time hearing a biologist say one of the best things that can happen to an animal species is that humans decide to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we decide to eat it, its population just skyrockets because we start husbanding them. And
Well, and there are entire plant species where it's
like
entire
corn.
Its entire survival strategy at this point is be tasty to humans.
Yeah.
And the thing is with plants, they have no problem with that.
Yeah. I'd like to start a policy, though, of not saying the word synthetic meat if I've been sick within a week.
Okay. I'm talking about future meat that is actually good.
I know. I'm just kidding you. Just teasing you, Jimmy Akin. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin. Open forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of over 70%. This DVD was made specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue, and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together, we might build up a pro-life culture. One person, one conversation at a time. To get your copy of the DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5 a copy, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Whatever I have learned, writes Catholic Answers founder Carl Keating, I have learned from the masters of the craft. In his new book, Booked for Life, a bibliographic memoir of an accidental apologist, Carl gives future generations a roadmap of what it takes and what it means to become a Catholic apologist. In the way only Carl can, he recounts numerous real-life situations he has encountered in his long career that illustrate the apologetic lessons he's learned. Then, drawing on a lifetime of experience, Carl reveals the books that helped him learn to defend the Catholic faith. Order your copy of Booked for Life today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. 888-31-TRUTH, our number. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we'd love to take it today. Daniela in Mexico watching on Facebook. Thanks for joining us on Facebook. Daniela, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. Okay, so this is my question.
Okay.
Jimmy, what is your take on the monogenism versus polygenism debate? So framed another way, what is the right way for a faithful Catholic to balance science and faith when it comes to the question of our anthropological roots and original sin?
Okay. So I need to start by explaining what those terms mean. Monogenism is the view that at the beginning of the human race, there were literally only two people, Adam and Eve, and that all human beings descend from those two people. Polygenism is the view that there at the beginning of the human race, there were more than just two people in the original human breeding population. There may have been two who the Bible records as Adam and Eve, but they weren't the only two. Or the Adam and Eve we read about in Scripture could be taken of as symbols of the original human race. And this has been a subject that has been much discussed in recent years, both inside the Catholic community and outside the Catholic community. In 1950, Pope Pius XII issued an encyclical called Humanae Generis, in which he addressed this question. And he said that at that time, that although it was possible for Catholics to hold the theory of evolution, provided certain stipulations were met, like God creates the human soul out of nothing and so forth, that that Catholics did not have the liberty to endorse polygenism because it wasn't clear how to reconcile it with the sources of faith that talk about things like original sin and so forth. Subsequent to that, there has been a lot of discussion of how might one reconcile polygenism with the sources of faith, because biologically, as the biological sciences have advanced and as we've gotten a greater grasp of the amount of genetic diversity in the human race after we cracked the human genome, if you talk to a scientist, they will tell you it looks like we have had some population bottlenecks in the history of the human race, but it never got below a few thousand. And that the idea that there were originally only two humans and that absolutely all the humans in history descended from those two with no additional genetic input, genetic scientists will tell you that's not supported by the evidence. So that's been one of the factors that has led to a discussion of this. Different Orthodox Catholics have different opinions on where the church is on this, because we haven't gotten in recent times a explicit discussion of this in a highly authoritative magisterial document. Personally, I've done a study of this question, and I've tracked very carefully how the magisterium has handled this in subsequent years since 1960. And the trajectory is there in the documents, if you read them very carefully, is one of treating this question progressively more cautiously and allowing various groups to propose ways of reconciling polygenism with the sources of faith. It, for example, in the German adult catechism that the German bishops released in the 1980s, it was reviewed at the Vatican, and the Vatican allowed it to be published. And it says, as long as you maintain these principles, it's possible to reconcile polygenism with the sources of faith. In 2004, there was a document called Communion and Stewardship that was released by the International Theological Commission. Now, that's not a body of the magisterium. It's an advisory body. It's run by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and it's headed by the president by the prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. He's the president of the International Theological Commission. At the time, that was Joseph Ratzinger. And in Communion and Stewardship, it discusses, without deciding between, different options for how the human race may have emerged out of Africa, so many thousand years ago, and how the human race may have started either as individuals or populations. And it doesn't decide between those two. And the documents of the International Theological Commission can only be published, which this one was, on the condition that the magisterium does not have any difficulty with what it says. That's in its bylaws. And so when Joseph Ratzinger certified this document for publication, he was thereby certifying that the magisterium didn't have a problem with what this document said. And so the way I look at that is the magisterium is presently allowing Catholics to take different positions on this. It's no longer the case that they don't have the liberty to explore this and hold this position. Now the church is at least allowing that to happen as these different cases illustrate. And there's more than what I just named. I can't go into them all, but those are two examples where the magisterium has taken a different tack on this issue more recently than it did in 1950. So I would say, in terms of what should Catholics believe, I would say they should believe that the sources of faith are true, and they should be receptive to how the church handles this issue in the future, but they should not be dogmatic about it one way or another right now. That's my view. I should point out there are other people who are also Orthodox Catholics who think the 1950 policy is still in place. And I respect those people. I have to say that in my own study of this subject, which has been a very careful one, I don't find that the evidence supports that. But I understand that, and I think that people need to not get overly insistent about this right now, because there are a lot of things in play, and I expect we'll be hearing more from the magisterium in the future on this subject.
Daniela, thank you very much for that call from Mexico. Thanks very much for your patience in waiting for us to get to you. 888-318-7884 is our number. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. If you've got a question about the faith, if you've got a question about a moral issue, maybe a question about religion more generally, all are welcome. 888-318-7884. We'll be right back after this.
We're ready and waiting for your call today on Catholic Answers Live.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed a list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
This is Colleen Kelly Mast of Mast Appeal, pondering the Christmas carol, O Holy Night. My favorite line is, "Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth." Do you feel your worth? Do you know how much God loves you? God so loved us that he gave his only son so that we could be saved from our sin and error. So let's rejoice in God's love this Christmas and let your soul feel its worth.
I like that drumming, Nick, on that number. Who's drumming there? Who's that drumming there? Is that you, Nick Chamberlain, operating the board and playing the drums at the same time?
That's Groovy Thursday music. And I talked to Nick earlier. He's going to get me a copy of that so I can use it to call dances to.
Nice.
I off the top of my head, I mean, because regardless of the musical structure of it, I know by listening to it, I can use that as a square dance hoedown.
Oh,
where the choreography is extemporaneous and I just keep calling until I decide to stop. But I'm hoping that maybe I can convince Nick and his group to give me a 64 count version of it that I could use to write dances to specifically go to and other forms.
Someone's
going to
snap an ankle. Someone's going to snap an ankle trying to square dance to something that.
Oh, no.
No,
that's
really?
Fine. No. I don't know what the exact beats per minute on that are, but people.
It's about a million. I think it's right around in the area of a million. That's a pretty groovy tune, Nick. Are you proud of it?
Sounds like it's maybe in the 120s or 130s, which is really good square dancing speed.
Yeah. You know what? When we're talking about a tune, maybe you could just keep playing it underneath. Like what, the bed just went away. You just disappeared. But now people have to go from their memory about how groovy it is. But
yeah, every Thursday. When you're watching a movie, they keep the soundtrack going while the characters are talking.
But it's hard for Nick to operate the board and play the drums at the same time.
That's true.
And eat his carrot with it. He's in there eating.
You could use a carrot as a drumstick. That would simplify a little bit.
Yeah. I love that Thursday song, though, Nick. Love that Thursday song.
Does it have
song.
A name?
It's called... he can't even think of the name of his own
They'll
song.
Let us know.
That's Nick Check and the Dead Century playing that song with Nick Chamberlain on the drums. And I'm feeling like a DJ, so let's go to Taylor in Manteca, California, watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching on YouTube, Taylor. Your question for Jimmy
Lard.
Huh? Yeah, hey, thanks, guys. My question is regarding our certainty. What kind of certainty can we have about the present state of our souls? And the Council of Trent says we can't know with a certainty of faith that can't be subject to error.
Right.
But then the Catechism says we can't rely on our feelings or works to conclude we're justified, but through a reflection of God's blessings in our lives, we can have a guarantee that grace is at work in us. So I'm a little confused. First John says that we can... You know, we can know, and Catholics usually point to Joan of Arc's statement, and so I'm just wondering, about you know, she didn't know.
So in terms of grades of certitude, the highest is the certitude of faith that doesn't admit of error. And Trent says that we can't have that kind of certitude regarding the state of our soul apart from, you know, special revelation. but any other level is something we can theoretically have. So the next level below that people usually talk about is what's called moral certitude. And moral certitude is one where although we have to admit there's a remote possibility we could be wrong, we have sufficient evidence that we can be certain of it, not absolutely, but morally, so that we don't need to worry about the possibility of being wrong. And lots of things fall into the category of moral certitude, like you can be morally certain your wife is not deliberately poisoning you, or you can be morally certain that this earth is not going to go spinning off its axis tonight while you're asleep and have us all perish in space. You know, there are lots of things that although hypothetically they're possible, we don't need to be worrying about them. And so the church has recognized that kind of certitude is possible. Doesn't mean it's justified for everybody. If you're engaging in sinful patterns of behavior, you may not have that level of certainty be justified for you. Also, some people, you know, have there's a possibility of self-deception. And so if you're using a sloppy reasoning process that's, you know, telling you, oh, yeah, I have nothing to worry about because I believed in Jesus when I was 6 years old and therefore I'm forever saved no matter what I do. Well, you're using some faulty data in your reasoning process because just because you believed in Jesus when you were six doesn't mean that you're unable to commit mortal sin and fall from grace, in St. Paul's words. And so you, even though you may subjectively feel very certain of your salvation, it's not actually supported by good evidence. But if you have good evidence and you're using good reasoning and the evidence points strongly in favor of you being in a state of grace, then you can arrive at a level of moral certitude where you don't need to worry about it. And that's part of the point of the passages in the New Testament, especially in John's writings where he talks about, I've written this so that you may know that you have eternal life. When he says no, he's talking about moral certitude. He's not talking about infallible certitude. The word no gets used like certitude with a spectrum of different meanings. And if you are applying in philosophy, like if you're a fan of René Descartes, if you really want to know what's infallibly what you know infallibly, it's a very small number of things like I think, therefore I am. Maybe you know that infallibly. But most things that we say we know, like I know psychelet or I know I'm on the radio, or I know it's dark outside. I don't know those with infallible certitude, but I do know them with moral certitude, and thus I'm entitled to say that I know them in that way. And in the same way, we can know that we have eternal life if we meet the qualifications that Scripture lays out for us knowing that.
Taylor?
Yeah. Thank you for the response, Jimmy.
No problem. Right. By the way, I love the name of your town, Manteca.
And I think you guys pronounce it Manteca, right?
Yeah.
But that's because you're in Northern California. Large. See, in Southern California, we pronounce everything the proper Spanish way.
And, here on the screen, it may be spelled differently up there, but here it's spelled like the Spanish word for lard, which is actually a really good flavoring agent and a healthy form of fat, so...
thank you, Jimmy. I noticed that's a definite distinction between Northern Californians and Southern Californians is certain names like Paso Robles. In Southern California, we call that Paso Robles.
Yeah.
But they call it Paso Robles.
Interesting. And, it's kind of like Palestine, Texas.
Some would say Palestine.
Or Lavaca, Arkansas.
All right. Or La Jolla. California.
Nobody says La Jolla.
People do say La Jolla. They don't. They're not correct.
Not natives.
And then some people get really uptight about Nevada.
Uh-huh.
But if people who – I'm sorry to say this, but people who actually grew up in Nevada or Nevada, mm-hmm. they don't care.
Yeah.
It's the people who moved there.
Right.
That want you to say Nevada. We've been are we off the air now in Nevada? We just went off the air in Nevada.
Well, anyone who's wondering, it's La Jolla, not La Jolla.
It looks like La Jolla. 888-318-7884. That's our pronunciation minute. And that's going to be a new feature here on Catholic Answers. Hope you enjoy it. We now go to Mark in Indianapolis. Indiana, listening on EWTN. Your question for Jimmy Akin, Mark.
So in Indianapolis, north of us, we have Carmel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and people want to...
Versailles on the Versailles and Carmel.
Oh,
anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So... it was suggested to me that I not read the theology of body, but get the theology of body in simplified language. So I went through it.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing struck me. So, male and female made complementary. They have a natural attraction made in the image of Jesus and Christ and God and the Holy Spirit and that kind of union together. The thing that struck me toward the end of this simplified version was that when we are souls are united with our bodies in heaven, we will still retain male and female. Of course, there's no procreation required at that point,
right.
But there was no explanation about what then. And so obviously I need to go research some more, unless Jimmy can tell me what's going on in heaven. Is it like the joy of union we feel in marital bliss in heaven, period? But why male and female still?
The male and female aspect is something that's intrinsic to who we are when we're created. We're by God's design, we are human beings, and human beings are creatures that innately have gender. So we're either male or female. In some unusual cases, it can be hard, you know, in cases of certain birth abnormalities and so forth, it can be hard to tell which is the case, but it doesn't change the fact that this is the way our species is created by God. And in the resurrection, we're not going to change species. We're still going to be humans. It's not like we become angels or something. That's you know, an idea you get in some fiction, like It's a Wonderful Life. But we're always going to be human beings. And as a result of being always human beings and a result of always being the same people we are now, even if we're in an upgraded form – we're still going to continue to have gender, which is intrinsic to our identity as humans. So doesn't mean we're always going to be using the associated anatomy, just like we're not always using the associated anatomy even in this life. I mean, it has certain specific functions, and we're not engaged in those functions even most of the time. So that anatomy gets used on an as-needed basis. And in the next life, because among other things, procreation won't be necessary to maintain the race because we're all going to be immortal, we won't be using the anatomy for its reproductive purpose. And there are even hints we may not be using it for its other purposes either. So it will be a very different state than what we're in right now. It'll be a much better state. The marital embrace is a pointer towards what the glory of heaven will be like. It's not actually as good as heaven. Heaven will be even better. But heaven also won't have the procreative orientation that the marital embrace does. And so we shouldn't expect it to feel like that necessarily. C.S. Lewis has a famous example in talking about this, about some people have trouble imagining how can heaven be perfect if we're not going to be having sex. Well, he uses an analogy of imagining little boys for whom the highest pleasure in life is eating chocolates.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like hard to imagine how can anything be more pleasurable than eating chocolates. Well, guess what? The marital embrace is. And you're not going to care about the eating chocolates when you have the marital embrace. And in the same way, you're not going to care about the marital embrace when you have heaven. But also notice the marital embrace does not feel like eating chocolates. And so we shouldn't expect heaven to feel like the marital embrace. It's just going to be way better.
Mark, thanks for the call. It seems like nothing is better than heaven.
Yeah, nothing is better than heaven.
Okay, I'm glad. Well, I'm glad we were able to clear up that theological subtlety. Mark.
You know why?
Because God is?
Because God is the best thing there is. So there's nothing better than God.
All right. God
and
is
heaven
good.
Is union with God.
Man. You know,
so it all fits together.
Yeah, it does fit together. And it's very enticing. It makes you feel very enthusiastic for the future when you think about that. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. Open forum is our topic. That means whatever you've got on your mind about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church is more than welcome. We'll take up more of those calls when we come back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
January is pro-life month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and his DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 each. That's a savings of over 70%. Both the book and the DVD were made specifically with you in mind to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds so that together we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of the book Persuasive Pro-Life or the DVD Making the Case for Life for just $5 each, just call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. We are coming near to the top of the hour, so we will try to move as quickly and felicitously as we can among the questions. And we start with Jim in Maryland. Jim, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Here I am.
Hi, Jim. You have a question for Jimmy?
You're on the air. What's your question?
I'm wanted a little clarity about our obligation to do penance. I know that if Catholics are called, generally that Fridays are a day of penance, and traditionally that's taken the form of abstaining from meat, and we can choose other forms of penance, and there are exceptions to those days. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little foggy on what the exceptions are. Is it, you know, the octave of Christmas, the octave of Easter, the entire season of Easter, any day that the church calls a feast, any day that the church calls a solemnity.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand your question. You're wanting to know when are we obliged to abstain from meat? Is that the question?
More generally, when are we obliged to do penance, let's say.
Okay. It varies depending on what country you're in, but I can give you the answer for the United States. In the Latin Rite in the United States, you are obliged to abstain from meat on Ash Wednesday and on the Fridays of Lent, including Good Friday, which technically isn't part of Lent. It's part of Triduum, but it's still a day on which you need to do this. So Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, and the Fridays of Lent. In addition, we need to fast, and it's a very limited form of fasting, but we need to fast on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. All other Fridays of the year are days of penance, but that the U.S. bishops have not created an obligation to select an alternative form of penance on those days. If you read the documents very carefully, and I have, and you can read about this at jimmyakin.com, if you look under popular posts at jimmyakin.com, there's one called Annual Lent Fight. And in the Annual Lent Fight section, it has an extensive treatment of what the documents actually say about this. But basically, back in the 1960s, when the U.S. bishops implemented the current legislation governing this for the United States, they terminated the obligation to abstain from meat on Fridays outside of Lent. And they encouraged and invited people to still do that or do something else, but they didn't create a new independent obligation to do some form of penance. So we're invited to do penance on those days, and liturgically they're days of penance, but we don't have a positive legal obligation to do penance on Fridays outside of Lent. And just like all of the days of Lent are days of penance, but we don't have an obligation to do anything specific on those except on Fridays. So that's a basic sketch of the current state of the law in the United States. Obviously, the law establishes the minimum of what you need to do, but you're certainly welcome to do penance in a greater degree on a greater number of days, but you don't have an obligation to.
Thank you, Jim, for that call. We go now to Michael in Lafayette, Indiana, listening on Facebook. Thanks for joining us on Facebook, Michael. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I've enjoyed the discussion today.
Thank you.
So have I.
I heard about great. I heard that G.K. Chesterton, his theology of the pint, the pipe, and the cross. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me because he lived during a time when alcohol was illegal, at least in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, mm-hmm. marijuana is becoming increasingly legal in America and in the world in general. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering what the Catholic teaching is on recreational marijuana use.
The Catholic Church does not have an official teaching on marijuana use in particular. The Catholic Church doesn't take positions on particular substances like that. What it does have are principles that apply more generally. If you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, for example, it's going to condemn the use of narcotics. The question is going to be to what degree does marijuana fall into that category? Now, narcotics is a legal category, and it's not one that you can just go to a secular textbook or a secular legal code and say, well, therefore this definition I found here applies to the catechism, because the catechism isn't a document coming from a secular legal tradition. So it's gesturing at a general principle, but it's not giving us a specifically cashed out form of it. The way I would approach it is, and I have to confess, I have a lack of experience with marijuana here, so I don't have the data I need to make an assessment. But if I apply the principles of Catholic moral theology here, there's a distinction between what's known as perfect drunkenness or perfect intoxication and imperfect drunkenness or imperfect intoxication. When someone has become so intoxicated they lose their moral faculties, then that if they're doing it without a good reason, like I'm about to undergo surgery and I need this for extreme pain control, then it's a mortal sin. If they are only imperfectly drunken, so they haven't lost their moral faculties, then it may be a venial sin. Then there's a, there are situations where, depending on how you want to classify them, there's very little influence and there's what you could call moderate or proportional use, which is not a sin at all to use alcohol with. I would suggest the same principles apply to other mind-altering substances, whether it's marijuana or heroin or anything else. If there can be situations – let's take morphine as an example. Morphine is commonly classified as a narcotic, but there are situations where it's okay to take morphine if you're, let's say, in a hospice.
Yeah.
You know, and you're dying and you need it for pain control. So – that's legitimate, but that's different than recreational use. If we zero in on marijuana, it is not generally viewed as being as potent as morphine or heroin. It might be more like alcohol in that respect. Here's where my own limited experience prevents me from being able to be definitive. I would say if there's a moderate use, if – there's a moderate use, then it's potentially not sinful, the same way alcohol can be used moderately, and in those circumstances it's not sinful. If one used marijuana to the extent of it becoming becoming imperfectly intoxicated, so you still had your moral faculties, then that could be venially sinful. If you used it to the extent of becoming perfectly intoxicated, then without an adequate reason like medical pain control, then that would be a mortal sin to do that knowingly and deliberately. So I would apply the same principles elsewhere. I just don't know, does marijuana have a moderate use the way alcohol does, or does it not? That's something that that is going to be a very divisive and politicized yeah. question, and I don't have the experience personally to be able to pronounce upon it. So I'll have to leave that open and just sketch the moral principles involved.
Thanks, Michael. We're going to go very quickly now to Angelina in Nebraska listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Angelina, you need to phrase your question as quickly as you can because we are very limited on time.
Okay. My question is, after a person dies and winds up in purgatory, are they aware of things that happened prior to their death?
In their own life? Presumably
no,
so.
No, through family life. The example that I can give you is a son commits suicide. That information was not told to the mother. The mother dies later. Does she, when she gets to purgatory, find out that the son committed suicide?
We don't know. We don't have specific information about how much knowledge the souls in purgatory have, especially regarding matters that don't directly bear on them. Presumably they're going to have a life review of some sort at the particular judgment that's going to examine what happened in their life, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be privileged to information about what happened in other people's lives. That's something that presumably could come out at the general judgment at the end of time, but it's not certain that it would happen at the particular judgment after an individual dies. So there's no way of knowing that. We just haven't been given enough information to know about that.
Angelina?
Okay. Thank you.
It's your thing.
All right. Thank you very much, Angelina. Jimmy, how much do we know about what happens in purgatory? It seems to me it's very limited.
It really is. There are various stories that are in circulation based on, you know, reports of encountering souls from purgatory. There's a lot of theological speculation. What we do know is that God will give us the holiness we need to be united with him in heaven. If you go to purgatory, you're guaranteed heaven. And it may be a bit of a bumpy ride, but you're going to get there in the end, and that's the most important thing.
Sounds like good news to me. Jimmy Akin, thanks so much for another great couple of hours. This is the way. When you're sick, come back to work and hang out with Jimmy Akin for 2 hours. That's the way to do it.
Just make sure you're not contagious anymore.
Yeah. Well, I did take an extra day to make sure I wasn't, because it's been nasty. A lot of people have been getting sick.
A lot of people in the office. So far, I've avoided it, and I want to maintain that.
Yeah. But you still have to come back tomorrow, Jimmy.
Yep.
Because we're going to do the big super special. So
don't get sick tonight. 20,
no, I'm as long as no one discusses artificial or synthetic meat, I think I'm going to be fine. Big super special 20th anniversary show tomorrow with special guests and reminiscences of 20 years on Catholic Answers. We're really looking forward to it. We hope you join us. Until then, we will see you next time, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.